Good afternoon, everybody. What a joy this is. My friend Linwood Barclay in Toronto, Canada, who I have not seen now for like at least 3 years. In fact, I think the last time I saw Linwood, we had lunch together in Toronto. Was it the occasion of the VoucherCon then?
I think the last time we saw each other was when I came down there and did that event with Ian Rankin.
Time is blurred, hasn't it? It's really hard with that hole.
That would have been February of 2019. I probably saw you in September of 19 when I did my the last tour I did with that time. So, yeah, that was.
Well, anyway, it's a joy. We have done Zoom events since, and this is Linwood's U.S. National Book Launch. So I feel particularly privileged to have this opportunity to chat with him. And I'd like to point out that this is his new book, Take Your Breath Away. And we have signed book plates that Linwood was nice enough to do for us. Shipping books in and out of Canada is not one of those things that's easy to do. But my hope is that by the time his next book comes out, we'll actually get him back here. And then you can bring your book in and get an authentic signature. How's that sound?
Sounds good to me, because if I have a tour with only one stop, I want it to be in Scottsdale. So
particularly if you're publishing in the winter.
That's right, especially that. And as long as I have just long enough to go to the Hotel Valley Ho and get a chocolate milkshake, I'll be fine.
I'm so glad to hear you say that. You know, it used to be that the valets at the Hotel Valley Ho knew me, and you know, they would take my car and keep it while I picked up authors and everything. And now I've got to break in a new bunch because with the absence of authors, it's like everything is restarting.
Oh, they'll learn soon enough.
That's very true. So I was thinking today when I did a little extra e-news for those of you who belong to our, who signed up to receive the e-news when I write to you, because I had put in the wrong time for this, about this weekend and the terrible news of the various shootings, and thinking to myself that there's really nowhere that anybody can confidently declare themselves safe anymore.
No.
But Linwood has always made us aware that suburbia, even though it appears to be safe, or small places, or occasionally big places, actually isn't. Do you think, you know, are you like a prognosticator ahead of your time?
Oh, God, no, I'm probably more a reactor. I'm just in horror to the things that happen. I think that's true of a great deal of crime fiction, is that, especially, you know, so much of the British crime fiction in the little villages or you know, Murder, She Wrote, the most likely places, the things where nobody would ever get hurt, they just have a murder a week. And, I always think, I cannot even now wonder if Jessica Fletcher, if she wasn't killing them all, you know, just to have something to do. But I think that's the appeal, I think, of a lot of crime fiction is when things happen in places where we don't expect them to happen.
Yeah. And a sense of dread. We were talking to Chris Bajalian yesterday, and he said that he always, you know, feels or tries to infuse his stories with a sense of dread. Yeah. And I think that you do that, but you also like to create not an impossible crime or a locked room mystery, but you like to create a situation that seems impossible and then resolve it somehow. I mean, your books are famous for their, you know, their surprises and their twists, but you can't achieve that if you haven't set up a scenario where the unexpected or the unthinkable has already happened.
Yeah, you know, and the thing is, you know, a lot of times you'll write something and an editor might say, well, that's just too out there. And yet, we all know and love Meg Gardner, and Meg Gardner often will on Twitter, you know, like the crime headline of the day. It's always something so bizarre that if you wrote it in a book, an editor would want you to take it out because it's just like, this could never happen, except things like that are happening every single day. But this book, you know, you talk about sort of taking strange situations. I mean, this particular novel, I had an idea. It must have been maybe 3 years ago. It was more than a couple of books ago, in which I had this idea for a scene where a woman supposedly out on an errand has been gone for a while and then comes back to her house, and she pulls into the driveway and she's at the right address, but the house that she left is not the house that's there now. It's a completely different structure. So the one that was there was raised and a new house was built there. And she gets out of the car and she says, where's my house? What's happened to my house? And I had thought, what a great scene, you know, but I could not begin to figure out what happened. So I just let it percolate for a while. And then finally I thought, I really want to do that book. And I just sat down with a notepad and a pen, and I sort of came up with like 10 possible explanations. And I immediately ruled out all the ones that involved alien invasion. That seemed a little too out there. or time travel. That didn't seem like a good one either. And I just thought, well, what could it have been? And finally I came up with one that I thought, yeah, I think I can make this work. And so that's when I decided to do that, this book.
Well, I mean, part of your genius is the setup. And then there's always some person who somehow or other is suspected of whatever thing happened in the setup. But you want to, as the reader, you can't assume that this person is, in fact, the perp. You have to wonder if this guy's ever... The reason I'm thinking about this one is that Mysterious Press is publishing A Locked Room, an Impossible Crime Mystery in July. And I read it the other day as a sort of break from everything else that I read to see how it worked. And, you know, it reminded me that, that the setup is to create a situation that will challenge the reader, but there always has to be a pragmatic solution to it. I mean, it can't be aliens and it can't be supernatural. So somehow when setting it up, you also have to have a reasonable, believable solution in mind for it. And I wonder, do you approach what you do kind of that way, like John Dixon Carr?
Yeah, well, I mean, I did have a kind of amazing situation, this woman coming home. And I felt I had to have an explanation that the reader will accept and won't go, you don't want anybody to read the book and go, oh, come on. And I don't want anybody to have an, oh, come on kind of ending. There has to be an explanation for it that is hard for the reader to figure out what it is. But once they get to it, it's like, oh yeah, that makes perfect sense. And as long as you give them enough sort of diversions and red herrings and other things that it could have been, but once they arrive at that point, they buy it. And I think that they certainly will in this book. And I really think that that it has to be believable. And I like to set my books, in a very real world. And you're right, there's there is a sort of immediate suspect, which is, what the backstory, and this isn't giving a lot away, but when this woman comes back to the house and says, where's my house? Where did my house go? The next door neighbor observes this and observes her getting all upset. And he looks and thinks, that looks just like the woman who used to live in that house 6 years ago who went missing. And of course, when that woman went missing, her husband was the most likely suspect that he might have done something, might have killed her, because it's, that's always the husband, right? And so this is a story that's very much from the point of view of this man whose wife did vanish 6 years ago and is now kind of getting his life back together. The police suspected him, but never had enough to arrest him. And now he's got a new life with a new woman. And then one day, guess who's back?
Well, habeas corpus is often a part, if there is no body, then there's a cloud of suspicion that is never resolved. So that's one of the things swirling around Andrew. Isn't that his name? Andrew?
Yeah, Andy. Yeah.
Right.
That's funny you should mention that, because every time I've ever seen a movie or ever read a book in which the body isn't found, I always wait. I'm always waiting. That person, somehow that person's coming back.
Or will be discovered, and is, I mean, if you really watch a lot of the great serial television being produced right now or whatever, you recognize that forensics are improving, techniques for finding bodies are improving, whether it's cadaver dogs or, LIDAR will probably be a fake, whatever. So it's increasingly difficult, I think, for somebody to completely dispose of a body. The most sinister one that I have ever really thought about, and it's really disgusting, but up in Yorkshire, there was a mystery in which the perp owned a pig farm.
And oh, yeah, yeah.
Really want to dispose of a body. Feeding it to the hogs is probably your very best shot.
We got a guy like that in Canada, Picton, Robert Picton from in BC. But I think everything I've learned about disposing of bodies, I learned from Breaking Bad, you know, big drums full of acid. But those are really hard to come by, you know, so you have to find something easier.
Well, and they arouse suspicion too. I mean, you know, yes. It's not that easy to roll them in. But, you know, the other part that I think is so often true in your books is that this person existing under the cloud of suspicion is actually really, really grieving, you know, really has sustained a loss. And so you have to ask yourself, is Andrew Mason an unreliable narrator in that he is secretly, inwardly gloating that his wife has disappeared and it's just a facade? Or is he truly, you know, subject to loss? And if he rebuilds his life, does that mean he didn't care about his first wife at all? Or does it mean that he is somewhat fatalistic in moving on? There's so many questions here. Do you write mostly from the male point of view, Linwood, in the books?
Well, not always. I mean, I think Elevator Pitch, my main character was a woman named Barbara, who was a journalist. And never saw it coming. It's from the really from the point of view of a woman who's a bogus psychic. And so I've kind of tried to mix it up some. I'd say probably the bulk of the books have been from a male POV as a main character. But I also like to think that when you jump around from chapter, you go into sort of somebody else's head, you may be in the heads of a lot of different characters through the course of a book. Can you see how the sun is fading now? All of a sudden it's gone dark in here.
It's blending off your glasses. I have this background of an open window because usually I do this at home in my office, but I'm perched up here in the really tragically messy office.
It may come back. Well, I may raise the blind a bit.
Okay. Well, the reason I asked you that question was that I'm wondering, you know, you say it's always the husband, but in a reverse situation, is it always the wife? Or is there kind of an assumption on the part of the reader that a guy is better equipped to do away with somebody than a woman? Maybe from a physical standpoint.
A physical standpoint, I think it really has to do with how motivated you are to get rid of somebody. And I think that either sex can be very motivated to do in a partner if the circumstances are right.
So in the opening chapter, so absolutely no spoiler here, the woman that we are discussing, whose name is Evie Elise, what's her name?
I've already written another book since this one. I don't remember anybody.
I'm looking. Sorry, I too have. Anyway.
Bree. His wife's name is Bree.
Bree, that's it, like cheese. Right, okay. So Bree is home in her house. Andrew, her husband, is away. And a plumber has been called. And just briefly, you sketch him in. And he could be just, you know, an ordinary plumber. Or he could be something worse. And because she has mice, that's the problem, I think.
Yeah, he's an exterminator, not a plumber.
Oh, he's an exterminator. That's right. Okay. But he's operating around the kitchen. Anyway, he suggests that in order to see if she really has mice, that she sprinkle flour on the floor. And if there are really mice, they will come out and leave little tiny mice tracks. Yeah. And then they will know whether to proceed with that. And, you know, even though this seems like a sort of everyday, you know, kind of a normal thing, an ominous note signs when Bree says something about her husband being away, and then she asks herself, but should I have said that, you know, that I'm here alone in the house? So that's the first little. And then when the guy does the flower thing, you have to think to yourself, really? I mean, is that a standard exterminator technique, or why would he want to be checking footprints, mice prints, in the kitchen?
Well, you know, in fact, this all came up because I was having a discussion with my agent, and we were talking about, I think we're talking about a place that we have, a little getaway place, and whether there were mice there. And this is, in fact, was, had been told to me by, I think, an exterminator said, if you put a bit of, you know, flour on the floor, if you're not sure whether you have mice, they'll leave these little tracks. And we got talking about it. And I thought, well, what if you spread the flour one night and you came down in the morning, and in fact, there were tracks in the flour, except they were a size 9.
Yes. So when we have to question what's the role of the exterminator here, and we go on from there. And that's all the very first part of the book. Yeah. So when you read it, you will not be surprised, but it's also not a spoiler. But anyway, Andrew, time goes on and time goes on, and Bree has disappeared and there is nobody. And eventually he begins to rebuild his life. Now, is it always in that moment when somebody really gets their life back together that the past intrudes?
Oh, I think so. That's the best time for it to happen from a writer's point of view. Just when you think things are going well, that's when, you know what hits the fan. And I think as I got writing this book, I started thinking a little bit about that Tom Hanks movie from about 20 years ago, Castaway, and how, you know, his wife, played by Helen Hunt, has to assume after a number of years that her husband is dead, not knowing that he's now carrying on an affair with a basketball named, whatever it was, Wilson. But he's just, but he comes back, and she has moved on. She has a husband. She has a new life because she thought he was dead. And then he's back. And I thought, what a horrendous situation for a person to be in. Like, to whom do you owe any loyalty? I mean, you're married to someone new. You thought this person was dead, but you were in love with this person, and they're back. And I thought, what a great sort of dramatic situation to create in the context of a thriller. And so that's part of the situation that we may be, you know, leading into, or think we are, in Take Your Breath Away.
Well, that has come up in various historical mysteries that are novels that I have read, when, you know, people sailed to India and they were gone for God knows how long, and their death would be reported or something. And then, you know, the people behind would move on thinking that it was all over, and then surprise, you know, they would come back. And one of the other wrinkles in that would be that sometimes you couldn't be sure that the person who came back was the person who left, you know, that it might be an imposter. Which is harder to do anymore, you know, because, again, stuff like fingerprints and DNA and facial recognition. I mean, the whole Lost Air plot is just gone, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I know. But even in the old days, you figure if your spouse had been gone for 10 years and then they came back and it was someone who looked totally different, but they said, you just think, well, you know, I don't have a picture of him on my iPhone. That could be him, I suppose. But it's just hard to believe you wouldn't know. I'm going to go open the blind a bit, just because it's now that we're still, I had the blind down so I could, you know, it's a long story, but let's be able to see me.
No, Zoom has its moments, just like a live event when, you know, the station.
There we go. Look at
that. That's better. That's very nice.
Oh, my God. No, I can't. Yes. I can already see you because I have the sun streaming into my eyes. But
you're lit up. You're sort of like a cameo now with the dark background.
As long as you can see me, you know, we're fine.
No, it's very dramatic. I really like that. So, you know, the other thing that poor Andrew has to work his way through is not only the loss of Bree and eventually whether he can restart his life, but the cloud of suspicion that is never really dispelled, that people he was friends with, you know, people in the community and so forth, really look at him, you know, askance, because they don't know either what might have happened. And without any resolution, he's in this kind of perpetual fog.
He moves not very far. He doesn't move a great distance away, but he moves out of the neighborhood where he was kind of known.
Right.
And because there's always a kind of a whispering going on, you know, that, you know, when you go through the mall or whatever, that somebody's looking like, that's the guy who killed his wife, or that's the guy whose wife they ever found. I bet he did it. So he's always had to live with this, you know, for the last 6 years, this knowing that there's this kind of whispering campaign, and knowing also that the detective who was investigating him back then, investigating Bree's disappearance, that she's still poking around at times because she's never given up thinking that he did it. And and then of course when there's this potential reappearance, that's that kind of throws the detective for a loop too. You know, like, was she wrong? But if it's her, what on earth has she been for 6 years? So there's all these mysteries. I mean, there's a huge mystery if it's really her, and there's an equally huge mystery if it's not, you know. And so she's but she's back in it, and now she's back in Andy's life and making his life miserable.
I'm trying to think which novel is it? Is it Crime and Punishment, or is it Les Miserables, where the detective
Javert, isn't it? Javert never gives up, keeps
that's exactly who it is, you know, just shadows this guy for his entire life and never gives him a moment's peace. And so she's a little bit like a female version of Javert. Absolutely.
I should have given her a name like Javert, you know, but that would have been a bit, you know,
or Javert with a T, if you really want.
Precious would have been to do that. I couldn't do that.
Yeah, but still. That is an interesting thing. I know that, you know, murder cases are never really closed. They may sort of be dusted away to the cold case file, but they're never formally closed. But, you know, a missing person case, do they stay on the burner too forever?
Well, I think they do, although I guess there reaches a point from a legal point of view when someone's missing a certain number of years, they are declared dead, or you could petition, I think, to have them
declared. Yeah, it's 7 years normally, because the law demands some kind of certainty in terms of marriage and inheritance and all the rest of it.
That's right. So, I mean, it would still be an open file, I guess, but, you know, since that person disappeared 6 or 7 years ago, God knows how many more there have been. So it's not, they don't have any kind of active investigation into trying to deal with it. I mean, it's, you know, trails run cold and they run out of ideas. And so all you can really do is wait around and hope something breaks someday, or somebody walks into the station and says, I want to make a confession, you know. And that's often the way these things get found out.
So often in your books, you do not have like the whole city of New York as potential players in the thing. And so you have to ask yourself, if something really heavy-cavey is going on, which of the people already in their lives might have something to do with it? Mm-hmm. I think you're very good at that. I think I read all your books, actually. We met, God, when was that? We met in London. No, we met at the Frankfurt Book Fair.
That's right. And that would have been probably 2008, which was the year that was for a book called No Time for Goodbye, yep, which was my big breakout book.
It was
my fifth novel, but it was the one that broke me out. And that was the single best-selling novel of the year in the UK in 2008. That one just kind of went supernova. That's when I decided to give up the day job. And just write books, you know. It still beats working for a living, you know. And whenever, even on the worst days of writing a novel, you think, well, think what it'd be like to work at a bank, you know. This is better.
Oh, absolutely better. Anyway, my point was that even though I have read all your books since No Time for Goodbye, and we have talked about them, you don't repeat yourself, you know. I'm always having to start at zero. I thought that was particularly true with Elevator Pitch, but it was also true of what was the guy? It was a neighborhood book. I can't remember the name of it, but that was another one that. So anyway, my point is that I've been trained to regard everybody in the book with some suspicion, because we don't really know what happened, but we know something happened, that somebody, it's already been introduced in the book, is probably responsible for it, because it's so unfair to bring in, you know, some completely outside agent.
Oh yeah, that's, you can't have, it's like saying the butler did it, but we didn't meet the butler until the last chapter. Oh, he has a butler, you know. But but it's interesting you should mention of not repeating myself, because that's the real challenge, you know, is to and you know, I've been doing a book a year, or some years too, but a book a year since 2004. And you want, it's trying to find that balance of doing giving readers what they want from you, from a Linwood Barclay book, and to be able to give them what's familiar, but at the same time, give them a story that they haven't had before. And often that's the challenge. And every time you write, you know, every time you write a book, you want it to be the very best book you've ever done. And some years you'd finish it and you think, well, it's, I don't know if it's the best one I ever did. I think the one I did 2 years ago is the best, but this one's going to have to get me by. And the thing is, often it's authors are the last to know whether it's a good one or not, because we've been so close to it. So we just have to, it's funny, someone said, oh, you know, they were referencing one of my books and said, oh, my favorite of your books is such and such. And I thought, oh, wow, that's actually my least favorite, but it seemed rude to argue with them.
Well, but you know what, Linwood, a book, and I think this is so true. No book is really complete until the reader reads it. You know, I mean, write the book, but every single person who reads your book really reads a different book. They read, you know, whatever they bring to the book. And I have sat with authors looking completely stunned, although trying not to, at a question that, you know, somebody in the audience has asked, and I can see in their mind, they're going, I didn't say that, or really, you know, how did you ever get there? But for the reader, it's a valid moment.
I think books, what's interesting about books is that books touch, as you say, everybody in a different way. And it often depends on what's happening in a person's life and at the time that they read your book. And I've had over the years, often had emails from people who, someone might say, you know, I lost my husband 3 months ago and I was reading your book, and it just, for at least a period of time, took me out of how I was feeling and it entertained me. I can remember that, this is going back to 1996. I remember I drove to Connecticut because my 90-year-old aunt was dying and I was the only relative to come. And I remember sitting in the hospital room with her and I was reading Roddy Doyle's novel, Patty Clark, Ha Ha Ha. And that novel always has a special place for me because that's the book that I read while I was just sort of with her. And so it takes on a sort of added significance that Roddy Doyle could not possibly have imagined, you know?
I'm always interested at people who like to reread books over and over and over again. I am not among them. I am a person who, I know that because, as you pointed out, that I have changed and life has moved on, that the experience that I had with the book, I can't repeat by reading it over again. So unless I think there is a whole new experience waiting for me, or that I missed something and I would benefit from going back to it, I don't reread books.
You know what I've been doing lately is I've been, you know, kind of reading sort of a very heavy or intense kind of novel. And then when I'm done and I think I need like a palate cleanser or I need something. And what I've been doing is I've collected over the years pretty much most of the Robert B. Parker's Spencer novels. I had the Ace Atkins ones too, but the originals. And I go on the shelf and I find one from like 1999 or 2001, and I haul it off the shelf and I have zero memory of the story. And so it's like reading the book for the first time. And so I just finished one. I can usually, you know, and you know, Parker was always a very fast read. I can usually read it about a day and a half. And it's fun to reread those because it's been enough time that I just don't remember anything about them. I read Widow's Walk over the weekend after I'd finished this wonderful novel by Emily St. John Mandel that was quite intense. And I thought it was just what I needed, you know?
No, I can see it. So you read The Sea of Tranquility?
Well, I'm working my way up to that. Actually, I'm being sent that book because we have the same publisher. But I had watched the HBO show Station 11 based on her novel. And I thought the show was just brilliant. And so I thought, I really want to read her. So I decided to read something other books first. So I read The Singer's Gun, which I thought was terrific. And then I just finished on the weekend The Glass Hotel, which I loved. And now I'm reading Station 11. So I'm kind of working through her backlist, and then I'm going to read the new one, which I hear is great.
You know, that's so much fun. We've had several, I did an event with Chris Bajalian yesterday, and I reminded him that television, because he has a couple of things in production, and Jack Carr, who we're going to be talking to here in a little while, has a novel, The Terminal, is coming out on the film version on July 1st. And it's interesting that it reaches an audience that doesn't even know a lot of the time that there's a book.
Yes, yeah.
So well, you just kind of, you know, you saw it and then you thought, okay, Emily's written books. I'll now read the book.
Yeah, but I was interested in reading Station 11, having seen the series on HBO, because the opening scenes, much of it take place about a mile down the road for me here in Toronto, but it wasn't Toronto in the HBO show. So a lot of it takes place in an area that I'm pretty familiar with.
So speaking of television and movies, you have anything going on?
I have I've got a couple that haven't been formally announced, so I can't really mention them, but I've had an option on one of the recent books for a series and another one of my books has been optioned for a series in France, which is where they made a series on my book, The Accident. And there's a lovely producing team that is still, after 4 or 5 years, trying to get a series made out of my so-called Promise Falls trilogy. For a long point, I was involved in writing the pilot for and an outline and so forth. And they're still trying. I don't know if it will ever come to anything. I've now have concluded that having a book optioned is like reserving a book at the library that you never pick up. You know, it's just right. somebody now has this sort of tenuous hold on your book, so no one else can make it into a TV show. And that's really all we intended. We just want to make sure nobody else can do it, but we don't know if we're going to get around to it or not. And so I vow to never get excited about any of these things until I'm actually turned on the TV and it's there.
Well, you know, you can cash the check and, you know, buy yourself a treat.
That's right. You know,
carry on. But you have to admit that long form television is an absolute gift to authors, you know, that many things are now that would never have made it to a movie and actually wouldn't have been good as a movie.
Oh, I know. It's true. It's, you know, having, say, 6-7 episodes to really tell a story, instead of watering it down, you know, sifting it, distilling it to its essence, can be wonderful. Now, sometimes the reverse is true. Sometimes you think, this could have really been done in 3 episodes, but they've dragged it out to 6. But generally, it's a really wonderful thing to be able to take a novel and really, really give it its due.
I think so too. And Promise Falls, isn't the trilogy, are those your only repeating characters?
Not entirely. I did do my breakout book, No Time for Goodbye. I brought those characters back for a kind of sequel called No Safe House. So they repeated. And then the first 4 novels that I wrote were sort of comic thrillers about a guy named Zach Walker. And so there are 4 Zach novels that repeat. So those are the main, and of course they did that so-called trilogy. And then I did a 4th book called Parting Shot with all those characters that referenced the events of the trilogy, but took place a year later. But it was a book that you didn't have to read if you hadn't read the trilogy. But now the last, I think since The Noise Downstairs, every book that I have done has started from ground zero, like just all new characters, all new, you know, everything's standalone.
Well, you and I have talked in the past about this, Zach Walker's. I mean, you were a journalist, right? Before, yeah. And the Zach Walker books were quite different really than the books you're writing now.
Yeah, the Zach novels were a little slightly madcap. Zach was a kind of anxiety riddled, pain in the ass kind of guy. I hate to tell you who he's based on. He's basically me unchecked. And all of my anxieties and everything I just threw into Zach. And Zach is well-intentioned, but his attempts to make his family safer backfire rather spectacularly. And so those 4 novels about Zach, I mean, they're books I'm very proud of. They're really good thrillers, but they have some pretty funny moments in them. And but you know, I had done the four of them. They came out between 2004 and 2007. And I'd like to say that collectively they sold somewhere like 84 copies or something. And so that's when I decided to kind of switch gears, right, and write a so-called big book, not about a series, and to lose the funny. And that book was No Time for Goodbye, and that did change everything.
So, but you're happy in your playground.
Yes. Oh yeah. What I'm doing now, yeah. Oh yeah. I thought perhaps you were able to see all the toys in the office, and that's what we were going about. But I like doing the standalones now. I'm trying to think if there's any character that I would like to go back to that I have written about in the last few years, and maybe Barbara from Elevator Pitch, because she's a really good character. Sometimes people ask if I'll go back and do, I did a novel, God, it must be almost 10 years ago now, called Trust Your Eyes,
right,
about a fellow who was completely addicted to maps. And
that's the book I was trying to remember, yes.
Yeah, completely addicted to a Google Street View kind of site. So he travels the world virtually, never leaves his bedroom. And not only does he travel the world, but he remembers everything that he's seen. And that's Thomas. He was a great character. And he sees something in a window in Lower Manhattan that is an image that looks like somebody being killed in a window. It's a kind of updated Rear Window. And I think that's still my own favorite of all the books I've done.
It's a lot of fun to read it. And, you know, one of the great things about doing standalones is that everybody is in jeopardy. There's no safety net for anyone. So, you know, except for killing the dog, which you really can't do. Although I did find out yesterday from, pardon me?
You can do it in a John Wick movie. You can kill the dog, but that's
apparently cats are more expendable. I found out by, you know, repeating this, there's something about cats that don't seem to have the same emotional that dogs do, whatever. Anyway, I'm going to call Zach back to see if we have questions, but I did want to tell you that swapping in a cruise in Russia on the river, hey, Zach, for an opportunity to do something else. The something else we elected to do, not this September, but next September, is cruise the Great Lakes, and we're going to end up in Toronto.
Oh, wow, that's
and
great.
So I thought that we could put together an entire Poison Pen Day in Toronto.
I think it's a great idea.
Wouldn't that be great? We could have Robert Povey, and we could have you, and we could have Vicky, and, you know, all kinds of Canadian authors. It'd be really fun.
Oh, that's a great idea. That's really cool. And it's really fun. I don't know are you aware of a book called The Push by Ashley Audrain?
Yeah.
So, well, she lives in Toronto, and I haven't even met her yet, but we have the book, and my wife's read it and really liked it. And I've been getting wrong mail to the house a lot lately. And it turns out it's for her. She lives around the corner at a house with the same number, but on a different street. And small world. And but that's a great idea. And of course, you know, we used to live out in the suburbs, but we live right downtown now.
I know you do, now that you live in downtown Toronto, but we will figure it out. So for those of you who are watching, I'd like to introduce you to Zach, who today is being Patrick. Hi, Zach. So, and Zach is going, do we have any comments or questions you'd like to bring up?
We do. We have a few from one person, is Stefania Giulianetti. I hope I'm saying your name right. First off, I think this is a pretty good question. Do you think the books you read have helped to create the writer you are today?
Oh, yeah. I mean, a lot of times when people are asked for advice on writing, the first thing I think most of us will say is you have to be a reader. So I think we've all learned from the things that we've read. I think that probably the writer who had the most impact on me at a young age was Ross Macdonald and the Lou Archer novels. But I think that, you know, we take something from all the different writers that we have read. And we learned from all of them. And the one thing I've learned is that I'm really glad that you don't have to be as good as some of them to get published, which because I'm so excited. On June 2nd, I'm doing an event like this. I'm interviewing James Lee Burke, and I've been reading him and have been in awe of his abilities for 30 years. And so I cannot wait to have a chance to talk to him, but he's someone, God, you could learn a lot from reading him about the power of language. So the short answer, yes.
Let me insert the comment that the most amazing thing about the James Lee Burke that you are going to interview, and Patrick's going to do it the day before, yep. is the foreword to the book. It's the yep. most personal essay from Jim that yep. I have read across the entire spectrum of his books.
It's a very personal novel.
Very personal. Anyway, I think Stefania is from Italy, isn't she, Zach?
I'm not sure. Stefania, where are you from?
I think she's from Italy, and she's clearly a night owl.
Oh, yeah, probably.
Would have
she's
to.
Got plenty of questions for you, too, so she's a big fan. Let's go on to the next question. What's the role of a writer today, in your opinion?
Oh, that's... There's so many. I mean, right off the top, it's to entertain. It's to take us out of our problems. But I think it's also to provide some sort of insight and perspective and clarity, because we live in, I think, a really confusing and challenging time in history. And I think some of the best writers will kind of help us get through that and understand what's going on and what we can do about it. And I don't pretend to be one of those authors, you know, in any sense. I mean, I try to write a book to entertain people and give them some sort of bit of escape. So I think that there's, you know, we serve a whole broad field of ways that we can try to help people out.
But don't you think that providing entertainment or escape is a perfectly valid function in a dysfunctional world?
Oh, I certainly do. And in no way am I demeaning it. You know, it's, I think we really need it. I mean, I think what I have needed more than anything lately is, you know, I've spent 30 years in newspapers, so I'm kind of a news junkie. I'm addicted to current events. And that's a terrible thing to be right now, because all the current events are horrendous. And sometimes you just have to, and doesn't mean you don't care, but you just have to turn away from it for a while just to preserve your sanity. And I mean, what's really funny is we watch the news so much in our household, and every once in a while we think, you know what, we have to watch an episode of the Andy Griffith Show. And that's what we need. That's kind of is maybe will get us through the lunch hour.
Okay, so on to the next question. How can you understand if a scene contains enough tension?
Oh, I just think that for me, that's just something that I just have a sense of. You know, if I'm getting bored or restless or whatever, then that scene's not working. But I, you know, it's like some people can play the piano by ear, you know, and they don't need notes. I think I can just kind of tell when there's tension. I think that the way to do that too is to, I like to end chapters in such a way that we build up to a point, and then we just sort of leave you there hanging, and you have to come back. You have to start that next chapter. I mean, I just love to show this. I what I love about books, and what even more than reading online about this, is books are so perfect. Like there's this white space that happens at the end of a chapter and this white space at the beginning of the next. And to me, that always sends a signal to the reader that something big just happened here, and then we're going to pick up over here. To me, this is a commercial break. You know, I grew up on addicted to TV in the 60s, and you know, there'd be that 15 minutes into a show, there was a commercial break, and you would run to the bathroom, you'd run to get a snack, and you had to come back. And I think that's the way to create tension is to build to those moments, and then where you feel that you just have to carry on.
All right. Next question.
That sun is calling you all of a sudden. Carry on.
Yeah, that's what it looks like.
Unbelievable.
Have you ever been inspired for your books by true crime stories, current or past?
Yeah, a couple of times. I'm trying to think now. I know that when I wrote The Accident, there had been a story in the news. Sometimes a news story will trigger a thought that becomes something else completely different. And so, for example, in No Time for Goodbye, there was a very tragic story in the Toronto area where someone broke into a house at night, and when the family woke up in the morning, their 14-year-old daughter was gone, and someone had come into the house in the night and had taken her out. And I was thinking about that story, and then I thought, what if you turned that upside down? What if the entire family disappeared in the night and the only one left was the 14-year-old girl? So that's a novel that was inspired by a real event, but became something entirely different. And when I wrote The Accident, or no, when I wrote Elevator Pitch, Elevator Pitch is a novel about a guy, who, a very different kind of serial killer, who gets rid of, kills his victims by sabotaging elevators throughout Manhattan. And that story was sparked by a news item in Toronto, where we have massive condo development along the waterfront. It looks like Hong Kong down there now. And there was a story in the news one night that said that the pace of construction was so fast that the city didn't have enough elevator inspectors to check on these buildings as they were being built. There hadn't been a problem, but they didn't have the inspectors. And I heard that on the news, and that idea was just there. What if you had a guy who was killing people by sabotaging elevators? And so the answer to the question is yes. A lot of times a news, a true story will spark an idea, but by the time it becomes a book, it's something totally different.
All right, next question. Do you think literature and culture can really change the world or people's lives?
These are deep questions tonight, right?
Where's the one?
Where do you get your ideas? Where's that question? You know, that's the one you're waiting for. Say that again.
Let me get back to it. It says, do you think literature and culture can really change the world or people's lives?
Yes. I finished the question. That is my answer. The answer is yes.
And I can give you a very instant example, which would be Uncle Tom's Cabin, a book that truly did inspire many things. Sometimes books have, in fact, created entire revolutions.
Yeah. Your answer was better than mine. I was going for the short version.
It was more specific.
Yes. Yes, they can.
All right. You have such a unique high concept ideas for your books. How many ideas do you pass on in between?
Oh, that's just, I need one really great high concept idea a year, really, basically. And I always figure it's out floating out there in the ether somewhere. It's out outside the window, or it's, you know, over here, or maybe it's across the street where I see people are moving. They're hauling all these furniture to the curb. I don't know what's going on out there. But I think there's probably a half a dozen through the year that, what about that or whatever, but I kind of know when it happens because it's just something about it that just excites me. And it sticks with me. It's an idea that keeps coming back to me. And it's not just a high concept idea. It's not enough that it's a kind of really neat idea. It has to be an idea that has enough going on in it to sustain, you know, 100,000 word, 400 page book. You know, it has to have a lot of layers to it. There has to be a lot under the surface. I mean, you know, a lot of times all my books will start with a what if, like what if that 14-year-old girl wakes up and the family's gone? Well, that's great, but it's still nothing if you can't figure out some interesting set of circumstances that brought us to that moment. So, you know, there'll probably be any number of them through the year that sort of thing, what about that? But if it's an idea that I keep coming back to, then I think there's something going on there.
All right, next, I guess this isn't so much of a question, but I guess I can turn it into a question. Do you feel like cancel culture has affected your writing in any way or in any capacity affects it?
Not cancel culture, but I think that to a degree, publishers are anxious about certain topics you know, I had without getting into details, I had a character in an earlier version of this novel, and there was a sense about whether this character was being accurately portrayed or whatever, and I finally decided it was rather than to try to deal with this issue, it was easier to change the nature of the character. And when I did, I discovered I actually turned the character into something more interesting. But there is, I think, there's a certain level of, oh, gee, can we do this and can we not? When in fact, you should be able to do whatever you want. And you know, this sort of sense, well, you can't write about this because you don't have that background or you're not part of that, you know, demographic, so you really shouldn't write about it. And I think, well, that's what imagination is about, you know, to imagine that you are in another group or another character, a different kind of a person, and let the market decide. If the market decides that you shouldn't have done this, then that book won't sell. But I don't think that writers should feel, well, I can't write about this because that's going to, you know, people are going to be upset about that. That's I'm not happy about that.
Okay, next question. When you read a book, can you enjoy it or do you judge it as a writer?
Well, I do. Well, I don't know if I'm judging it as a writer, but I'll judge it. You know, I'll read, I read a lot of books and I'll read them and I'll think, and I do pass judgment. And I tend to, I post on Twitter a lot about books that I've been reading, and I tend to only post about the ones I've liked, because I know that it takes a lot of blood, sweat, and tears just to write a bad book. So I don't want to go on there and just, if I didn't like a book, I'm just not going to talk about it. I won't mention it, but I certainly judge them and I'll read them. And I mean, I was reading a thriller not too long ago where a really big reveal, a really crucial part of the book happened in the middle of a chapter. And I thought, don't do it there. You do it at the end of a chapter, because then it has this kind of punch to it, it has this impact to it. So yeah, so I do. I think a lot of us as writers do. But you know, for every writer, there's a different way of going at it. And but sure, you know, I'm no different than readers. Readers judge too.
Yeah, I think that's personal. I think that's fair. Yeah. I think you brushed upon this like earlier, but what's the legal time period before being declared legally dead? 7 years? Spouse need to wait or be
it,
a
it may vary country to country, but in the United States, it's generally 7 years. And interestingly enough, the people most interested in that very often are insurance companies, life insurance companies, and they have their own investigations because, you know, if they're going to have to pay out in a missing person or dubious situation, they don't really want to claw their money back. So, you know, it can be for that. It you know, marriage law, there are a whole lot of reasons why you have to come to a conclusion. I'm not sure. Is it the same in Canada, Linwood? I
can't tell you for certain, but I believe it is, and it falls in that sort of neighborhood. It
probably is English common law, so it's probably the same, you know, in Canada, in the U.S. and whatever. But
same length of time that you have to keep your receipts.
Right, but it might be different in France or something.
I go through the closet and I find boxes of tax receipts that are 7 years old. I think, well, I can throw these out now, and I can also get that guy declared dead. That's the way I do things.
Right, which seems great. That's a lot of really good questions, Zach. Is there one final zinger before we sign off?
I think there is. This one looks like a pretty juicy one. What scares you the most when you read a book?
Ooh, that is a good one.
What scares you most when you read a book? You know, I got to be honest. I mean, I've read books that are scary and that I've loved, but I don't think books have ever scared me quite as much as either movies. I was going to say, they don't scare me as much as current events. You know, I think that probably what scares me in a book is not so much a scary event or a description as just a writer who's so good that I go, man, like, how did you do this? Like, it's just, that scares me. Like, how could you be that brilliant? How could you write this that's so good? That's mind blowing.
Wow, that comes back to that whole judging question in a way. So if you're judging yourself now, you're not judging the other writer.
You know,
it's really interesting.
I mean, recently now, because I've become really taken with these works by Emily St. John Mandel, when I was reading like this Singer's Gun and The Glass Hotel, I'm thinking, there's something about them that I can't quite put my finger on that makes them so good, but they have this kind of sort of ethereal quality about them. And I can't quite put my finger on what it is that makes them so entrancing. But I don't know how you can teach something like that. You can just either do it or you can't.
Yeah, but you have to hear that voice, Linwood. You know, all of us is like wine. We all have different palates for wine. We all have different palates for prose. And, you know, what turns you on may not work for somebody else. But isn't it wonderful when that synthesis occurs?
It's like when I eat a Twinkie and my wife looks and says, how can you do that?
Right. Yes,
how can anybody do that, you know?
That's a really excellent question. I discovered an author that I'm about to talk to is living on Fruit Loops. He told me that at dinner last night, and both my husband and I went, Fruit Loops, seriously?
That's a bridge too far. That's
what I think. In any case, thank you very much for your wonderful questions. Zach, thank you for stepping in and doing this. It's actually a lot of fun, isn't it? Get involved in it. Linwood, it's always a joy to talk to you and for all of you watching.
I can't wait for your cruise to come here to Toronto.
We're gonna actually do like a whole day. Poison Pen talks to authors in Toronto. It's gonna be fun. Tomorrow is the actual publication date for Take Your Breath Away. And as I mentioned before, Linwood very kindly signed book plates for us. And I'm sure he's going to come and see us in the near future. So you can buy your copy with a book plate, then you can bring it back and get it autographed by the man himself. So bye, everybody. Linwood, I don't have my usual glass to toast you, but consider this a sort of empty champagne glass here. And
that's fine. Thank you so much.
Good night, everybody. Thank you for joining us. Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.